The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
Hey, welcome to part two of the Partially Examined Life episode 142 on Plato's Phaedrus. We last time talked about the views that Plato was arguing against here, which showed up in a speech that was quoted from a guy named Lysias, and then a supplementary speech to that that Socrates gave on his own to sort of improve on that view that love is controlling, love is bad for the beloved, ultimately. And here we're going to get toward something closer to Socrates' actual view, the positive, why love is good.
And Socrates was ready to leave, and then his daemon holds him back.
So we are up to 242b. I was about to quote, "As I was going to cross the river, good man, the demonic thing and the sign that customarily arises for me arose, and on each occasion holds me back from what I'm going to do. And I seemed at that very moment to hear a certain voice, which is not allowing me to go away before I have made expiation on the grounds that I have committed some fault toward the divine." So this is him pulling his demon, which he brings up very often. One of the secondary sources I was listening to said something like the most specific and descriptive he's ever been about his demon, but I don't see that here. I don't know. He's just saying it's a voice.
I think we should sell Socrates' demon plush toys.
That's what I want. I want him, if he's going to say that, he has to define that could be what demon is, right at the beginning.
Right. Define it so that we can draw it and then make a toy out of it. And there the merchandising empire begins.
I think it's just an eight ball that just keeps coming up with no.
Or what was that character in He-Man? Didn't He-Man have his own daemon or something?
I think you're right. I was thinking that there's His Dark Materials, I believe, is the name of the kids' series, The Golden Compass, where everybody has a demon on their shoulder.
Right.
That is like part of their soul that has been...
Well, it's not always on their shoulder. Well, it's an animal of some kind.
Yeah. Or yes, it might be too big for that. So we got that little cameo from the demon, and that's just the transition that hey, Eros is a god. We've been saying these bad things about love, but we have to... I feel the need to get poetic here and to give a hymn of praise.
Well, also, it's an act of atonement. He needs to atone for the sin of speaking against love, the divinity. And so now, this speech of praise is the thing that's going to get him off the hook. It's going to redeem him.
And Socrates initially says that this is going to be a renunciation. Just like they've taken Lysias down a few pegs, he really kind of bitch slaps Homer for not being able to figure out why Homer lost his eyes. But at least Stesichorus had the good sense. He was a kind of, like, Stesichorus was a bit of a philosopher poet. He could figure out why he had lost his sight. And Socrates is going to top them all by actually doing his palinode before he gets punished. He's going to do it prophylactically. Right.
So writers, if you go blind, it's because of what you wrote. There you go.
It's not for any other reason at all.
Or all the masturbation. You have to spell it out? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not going to touch that with a plane tree.
All right. So who wants to sum up this lengthy speech we've gotten in the last episode? Wes gave us the answer, the kind of upshot of it, but we didn't get a lot of the progression here.
The divine madness and all that stuff.
He began the transition into this. He says, well, we really didn't examine the case of when the lover is of a different sort of nature, a nobler and gentler nature. It's the kind of language he uses. And so the structure of the speech is that he begins by talking about, because we sort of established that in the previous speeches, it was the insanity of the lover, which was a problem, and the non-lover should be favored for reasons of sanity. So he's going to start out by talking about the blessings of madness, which are threefold. One of them has to do with prophecy. The other has to do with a sort of ritual distraction from our present ills. When you're cursed, you sort of engage in purifications and sacred rites, whether or not they're effective, and they take you away from those ills in some sense. And then the third is artistic inspiration. And then the next part of the argument has to prove that madness is something that will, that is given by the gods for greatest happiness. And to do that, he starts out by proving that the soul is immortal, which is a long and interesting argument that I spent way too much time on. I have the feeling we're not going to get into that very much. And then giving a theory of the soul in which there's, it's this sort of composite of basically, it sort of combines this idea of a tripartite structure of the soul with his theory of recollection, where it's a way of giving a theory of madness as involving recollections of beautiful things that we've seen in souls before they inhabited our bodies, let's say.
When we were gods.
Sort of, yeah. All right, we'll get into that.
When we tried to follow the gods, something like that.
That gives him a basis for saying, giving a new theory of what the lover does to his object, which is essentially it's going to be that he improves the beloved.
You know, if you look at Socrates' second speech, I mean, it is really long. And especially since we're talking earlier about the different kinds of uses of language or uses of speech, for me, I think it's important to see that the first part of Socrates' second speech is essentially a philosophical treatise. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you could read from Aristotle or somebody else who's just, you know, kind of working through an argument. And then at some point, it switches into this kind of mythical thing about the chariot with the two horses and the charioteer and,
right,
and all that kind of stuff. And I think this is important, even though Socrates never calls it out explicitly, it's important later because it turns out that even implicitly within the Phaedrus, even a philosophical treatise is a kind of rhetoric and therefore going to be ultimately not as good as pure dialectic. But the other part is, I think that it's worth seeing that despite all of this high-blown stuff about divine madness, what madness actually means in this case is really kind of mundane. At 249d, Socrates says, standing aside from the busy doings of mankind and drawing nigh to the divine, he is rebuked by the multitude as being out of his wits, for they know not that he is possessed by a deity. And then at E, Socrates says, as soon as he beholds the beauty of this world, he is reminded of true beauty, his wings begin to grow. Then is he fain to lift his wings and fly upward, yet he has not the power. But inasmuch as he gazes upward like a bird and cares nothing for the world beneath, men charge it upon him that he is demented. And I take it from this that part of what this so-called divine madness is about is that to the rest of the world, it looks mad that a philosopher or somebody who's in touch with this truth doesn't really give a crap about what's going on down here because all of his attention is to the reality beyond the heavens. And that's what makes it mad, not that he's actually literally doing anything crazy. It's just that he's focusing on a different realm of existence and everybody else just can't understand it.
So I just want to finish the 249e that Adam was reading because it actually connects it back to love. We've been saying all this stuff about the theory of forms and the soul being immortal, but like, what does that have to do with love? This being in a manic condition, being demented, as your translation said. This therefore proves to be of all inspirations the best and of the best ancestry or caused by the best, something like that, both for him who has it and for him who communicates a share of it, and that he who participates in this madness as one who loves the beautiful ones is called lover. So there you go. That's what being a lover really is. It's not having a desire for you sexually that overwhelms me. It's being possessed by divine madness. We haven't even brought in why this is aimed at you in particular, but Wes gave us the answer, which is spelled out in here. I'm trying to see how many more pages it is before we get to it. It's at least a few more, at least a little bit, that it's the beauty in you that participates in the form of the beautiful. So really, that's the thing that I see in you that is why I love you, is because I am loving the divine through you, which is exactly the same answer that's in the symposium.
Well, one other thing about just the madness part of it, you remember the definition of love we got in Socrates' first speech was, it's when desire for beauty overcomes our reasonable side as it's culturally defined, cultural norms. And here it's this loving the beautiful to the point of madness where we sort of get spelled out what this defiance of those cultural norms are. So, as was mentioned, ignoring what the masses think and the fact that they laugh at you when, because you're stepping in potholes, because you're thinking about things rather than being practical, those sorts of things.
Well, I think the thing about the beauty, which we were touching on a little bit earlier, is that physical beauty in the world that we live in turns out to be a kind of wormhole. That when the philosopher experiences physical beauty in the world, what he's reminded of and what he's moved by is that he's transported from thinking about the physical beauty that's actually in front of him to the actual form of the beauty that exists beyond the heavens. That's why beauty is so powerful, is that it transports us to this other realm. And then, of course, you start paying attention to that other realm and not to this realm. And that's what everybody else thinks is crazy. And if I can be vulgar for a minute, and I listened to some of your podcasts, and I heard some vulgarity, so I thought it was thought it was okay. But, you know, in some ways, the bumper sticker here is that the beloved is supposed to be a wormhole and not a cornhole.
Yeah. That's very well put, which is not to say, and I think you're making this point, but just to make it more explicit, looking at beautiful bodies, that can be one of the inspirations. That can be one of the wormholes. This isn't simply saying, oh, I'm only attuned to the beauty of a person's soul as opposed to their body. You can be attuned to the beauty of people's bodies and still have that remind you of the, I'm going to use the word abstract, I'm not sure that's right, but the abstract beauty that you have encountered in the other world.
Even if you listen to the kind of language that we normally use and just take the language seriously instead of metaphorically, that beauty of that kind can actually transport you.
Right.
Now, if you think about that literally, it can transport you from this realm to the other realm. I mean, there's a famous picture, which we actually use on our website. It's called the Flammarion engraving. And maybe you've seen it, where it's a kind of country vista with the sun and the stars. And there's a guy poking his head out of the cosmos, kind of looking at the machinery behind the stars. And I think this is the kind of sense that Plato and Socrates have, that there are certain things that can kind of take us beyond the heavens to the realm of true being that we don't come into contact very often, while our souls are embodied in this realm.
Right. Again, that can include these the transporting things are not necessarily in and of themselves spiritual. They can be very sensual.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, you know, we're kind of back to like the cave in the Republic or something, that the beauty of the beloved is a shadow of true beauty, but it's by experiencing the shadow of beauty in the beloved that one can be either reminded or start seeking the absolute beauty outside the cave, as it were.
Yeah. And the same thing is in the Ladder of Love in the Symposium. You know, it starts with the love of beautiful bodies.
Right. And I think you move on to beautiful souls, but they are just steps in the ladder, and the Phaedrus, they're different mechanisms of being transported, let's say.
I want to take seriously, while Socrates or Plato is not giving us the image of the highest form of love as being giving beauty a hand job or something like that, right? It's
you're never going to outdo the cornhole.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to do
nice
that.
Nice try.
I was going for it. But there is a commonality. I don't think it's a coincidence that it's not merely steps along the way. There's something fundamentally the same on the, I guess it would be the kind of madness it is that he's talking about, that where you are, as Adam said, transported, but there's something about it that is you're being pulled along. That's what would be common in them. That when you are pulled by something beautiful, it is something that is acting upon you as much as you are towards it. And that is one of the things that's happening even at these highest levels, is that you are being spoken to by the divine.
Yeah.
We should get at what the other world, what the divine, what the elements of the myth are here. And it starts at 246. A toward the end. I want to hear what somebody else's translation says, because mine starts with, it is like some naturally conjoined power of a winged team and a charioteer, which seems very awkward. So somebody have something nicer for that.
On 246A, my Hackforth. Let it be likened to the union of powers in a team of winged steeds and their winged charioteer.
Oh, that is worse. That is so much worse. The powers and their winged steeds. Adam, what does yours say, Wes?
We will liken the soul to the composite nature of a pair of winged horses and a charioteer. So it's not so bad.
I guess they're all terrible. Adam, what is your sense?
No, I got the same as Dylan's, although I got a couple other. Okay. But wait, what's so terrible about it?
I think it's just a hard to translate Greek phrase.
The problem is, Mark, is the Greek is winged horses, right? The Greek is to palai pterote, right? Pteros for wings, like pterodactyl, and palai is just horses. So it's winged horses. That's literally what it says.
Actually, my objection was to the previous phrase, which is the how are they related to each other, which mine said the naturally conjoined power of a winged team and a charioteer. And then there's a footnote that says naturally conjoined is more literally grown together.
The word is sumphuto.
Anyway, so it's probably just one of those things that sounds fine in Greek.
The word for nature and grow are the, you know, that footnote is a little too clever. It is naturally conjoined, and because nature and growth are conceptually so intertwined.
I think the point here is that it's a tripartite soul.
Exactly.
And therefore, yes, that these three things, they don't have independent existence,
yes,
absent their participation within that tripartite soul. So if you're thinking, you know, conjoined twins, or that all the pieces here are, on the one hand, they're separate, but they're ultimately part of a single thing.
Yeah. So if you imagined a hydrogen atom in which if you took the electron out or the proton out and the neutron out, you would no longer have anything. Right, they didn't have any existence apart from themselves.
What if one of your horses breaks free? Sorry.
You got to tame your wild horses.
It can't do it. Because
that's my problem.
It pulls you along with it.
It does. And it's such a comical, the whole account is just amazing, of the bad horse.
In his vision, right, none of them is ever apart. There's always three of them. But one may have more strength than the other. Your bad horse might overwhelm and not be able to be tamed by the charioteer. And it's interesting because you would think that the charioteer would be simply something like yourself and you're controlling your good horse and your bad horse. But that's not exactly it. It's that all three of them form a soul altogether. And the charioteer is part of it, but the white horse and the dark horse are also part of your soul. It's not as if the charioteer is your soul controlling your physical passions versus your intellectual passions, and those are separate things. Those are all one thing.
Right. Well, that's why I don't understand why this seems like such a problem. I mean, if you look at Freud's soul, it's a tripartite soul with the id, ego, and superego.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's fundamentally, I mean, the component parts are not one-to-one,
yep,
but the notion that each one of them...
If you're referring to me, I wasn't saying it's a problem by saying it's comical. The story gets comical when we have... The bad horse pulling them towards the lever, and then the charioteer pulls up, and it's pulled up onto its haunches, and just all of that stuff, which is great.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you do it by comparison with Freud's, for example, I mean, it's not exactly the same tripartite soul, but it's almost like you have like a good id and a bad id here, but then you have some kind of not exactly superego.
Well, for Freud, it's all id deep down, so ego and superego are just articulations of id. So,
not Plato's view.
No, but I'm just this whole ego, superego, id comparison. I think it works.
But in any case, you've got these two, just think about the picture of it, that you've got these two motive forces pulling you in somewhat different directions. And there's some other part of you that's trying to negotiate or command or control those two separate impulses. And there's a good way to do this, a successful way to do this, and there's failed ways to do this.
And what you just said is the part that I found most interesting, and Wes said he spent too much time on it, which was the whole reason why our souls are immortal is this motive force.
Your self-moving.
Self-moving character of our souls.
Yes. I mean, that goes to the very nature of the fact that what we think of as ourselves today, it's an ensouled body, but you can tell that when the soul leaves the body, you're just left with a corpse. And so that clearly wasn't you, and that thing that came into the body and then left the body is existing forever. And that's why I think, you know, in this dialogue and in the other Platonic dialogues, for Socrates, it's really important to understand the place that life on earth fits within some kind of larger cosmic soul economy, as it were. Because if you don't understand the place that life on earth fits within that, you won't know how to live properly during your time here.
Are we going to go over the argument for the immortality of the soul?
I don't think we should. I think what we've just said is probably sufficient, that it's the self-moving thing, and a self-moving thing could have no beginning. That's really what it comes down to. A self-moving thing, by definition, if something else moved it, that would be the start.
The soul is a self-moving thing, which means it has to be a sort of principle of movement for the universe, a beginning of movement for the universe, which means it can't be destroyed or created, and that's where you get the immortality from. I'm not going to go over all the details, but it's an intricate and really fascinating argument, actually.
And he says right there that that part is a proof. But then immediately after that, he moves to the chariot,
right,
which is a metaphor, which is an image.
You know, and as Adam pointed out, it's just like it's such a different tone. That's why I sort of got waylaid in the proof of the soul. It's more, it's like, oh, here's an interesting, it's as if Aristotle or Kant is writing now.
It's a philosopher's honeypot.
Yeah.
You got stuck in the trap because it, exactly. It turns out that it's just another piece of rhetoric.
Exactly. Well, it's not just rhetoric.
Well, yes, right. But it's a specimen of rhetoric.
Yes, but it's not just rhetoric.
But this is what
I
want to ask.
If it were just rhetoric, it would be the bad sort of rhetoric.
Touche, yeah. Touche.
Do we want to think that Plato actually believes or is saying that Socrates actually believed in reincarnation, say? Like, this is part of, if you're saying the soul is immortal, but yet obviously the body's not immortal, then what is the soul doing the rest of the time? Either it's sitting up in Platonic heaven, comes down once, and then goes back to Platonic heaven. That's kind of what I assumed that his view was. But in this dialogue only, as part of this picture of the chariot that is whizzing around the heavens and occasionally will be dragged down to earth, and then you'll have an earthly life, but then it'll get back up there and maybe it'll follow the gods and see the forms, see the wonderful realm of the forms, and then maybe it'll go back down again. And it does this rotation thousands of times, and the going back down to earth, you know, so gives a very samsara, gives a Vedic take on reincarnation. You know, if you've lived the life of a philosopher, then you might ascend, you'll get out of the cycle more quickly. It sounds right out of Buddhism here.
Not might, will.
Well, yeah, in only, what, 5,000 rotations, whereas 3, the others 000. Will take.
Yeah.
Or only 3,000. The others 10, will take many 10, thousand.
10,000. Yeah. He's very specific, Mark.
There you go.
But Mark, I think the question of which of these things did Socrates or Plato actually believe, and did they actually believe these myths, misses the point of them being myths. I don't think the status of whether they were true exactly or not is the point of them. Just like at the beginning of this dialogue, going down too deep and asking, well, where did the griffin and where did the chimera come from? And then where did their ancestors come from? That will take you on forever and you'll never get an answer. So you have to hold the myths on their own terms.
I guess the question is just, where does myth start and stop here? That we had the argument for the immortality of the soul, clearly not myth. Then this thing about the chariot going round and round, well, it's a myth, but it's clearly just a metaphor. Like, he really does have a tripartite picture of the soul, and this is one way of putting it. And so saying, that's a myth, don't ask whether it's true or not, is kind of, you don't say that about a metaphor.
Yeah, it's a mythological way of explaining rationalism, right? This idea that to be in touch with the truth of things, we have to have been set up beforehand, a priori, with these, what he's calling recollections, but with the cognitive apparatus that puts us in touch with the truth. You can think of it as a myth of us having seen beauty in this divine realm, or you can think of it as the sense in which we are, that it's in our nature to respond to the beautiful in this way. In other words, that when we respond to the beauty of a particular thing or person, whether it's physical or psychological or whatever, it means more than that particular engagement. It means more than that particular response. It is also a response to beauty in general. That's the important point here.
I want to push back a little bit here, because I think that on the one hand, this very dialogue, the Phaedrus, tells us that scientific rhetoric, or rhetoric done properly, one of its features is that it presents a likeness of the truth. It doesn't present the truth itself, but it presents a likeness to the truth. And, you know, this is not the only place where Socrates talks about this soul economy. And there's a little bit in the Phaedo, for example. And, you know, Socrates, I think at the end of the day, is quite clear that he says, I don't know the truth of this. I mean, only God knows, and I don't know. But I have to believe, based on all of this reading, that Plato, and therefore Plato's Socrates, take the essential element of this as true, which is that the conduct of our life in this world is going to have consequences beyond this world. And that's why in Plato's dialogues, philosophy is not a system of thought. It's a way of life. And that's why it's important for people to be recruited, or if you want to think about it in religious terms. In this dialogue itself, Phaedrus is, quote, converted, I think, into the philosophical life. And essentially, again, if I continue with the religious language, it literally is the salvation of his soul, because he'll be able to conduct his life in this realm properly, which will, first of all, prevent him from coming back as an ox or a dog or something in a future life.
His own argument is that to create likenesses to the truth, we have to know the truth in some sense. That's the argument at the end of the dialogue. And, you know, when we say likeness to truth, I mean, I think we agree there. It's just, this is a metaphor. And the problem with metaphors is that it's not quite clear how far you can extend the metaphor, what exactly the truth it's trying to convey. So, for instance, you might think of this idea that, you know, your actions in this life have consequences beyond, and sort of the reincarnation aspect of this. You might take that as the import of the myth, or it's not as relevant.
When I was listening to you, Adam, I thought that you could easily just say that how we act and what we do affects our souls.
Right, exactly.
And whether or not that affects our immortal souls and our life in the hereafter, that's another piece of it. And that's certainly part of the myth. And maybe that's part of the rhetoric as well. Maybe it's part of its persuasiveness. But at the very least, I can see through this one and through the criticism of bad poetry and bad rhetoric that all of it comes down to those kinds of things are bad for your soul. They're bad for the most important part of what you are. Now, it's not clear to me how it cashes out on whether or not the soul is, quote unquote, actually immortal or not. It seems to me that at the very least, you have in the myths that it's perfectly right to consider them as immortal and treat them that way. You know, I don't know if there's even a funny kind of Pascal's wager going on in the persuasiveness of it, but the fact that those things affect your soul, and that therefore, because they do, they matter, and that it matters that they are done rightly, that seems to be the core of it.
I mean, the immortality of the soul is important to the argument just because it's important to the concept of recollection. That's its function. It's a mythological explanation of how we might have these sorts of recollections so that when we have a particular encounter with beauty in this world, it means something transcendent. It means something more than simply this particular encounter with beauty in this world. And if you want to interpret that literally in terms of the heavens and afterlife and things like that, I think that's one way to go. But it can also mean something much less religious, much less elaborate. It can really just point to the same sorts of considerations that other rationalist philosophers historically pointed to.
Right. But I think that now it gets back to, you know, what the purpose of the exercise that we're engaged in is. If the goal is to understand this particular text or one of the other Platonic dialogues, then it may be that what's meant in this text is different than what's meant in some other rationalist philosophy. Because I take it that in the Phaedrus and in the other Platonic dialogues, one of the key issues is what's the dog and what's the tail? For the multitude, for the masses, where we live today is the dog, and maybe there's some hereafter, and if there is, it's the tail, and it doesn't really matter. But for Socrates and for Plato, where we live today is the tail, and that the dog is someplace else. And it's the philosopher who knows that and spends his time attending to the dog and not the tail. And that's why the people down here think he's crazy.
So this is the ambiguity involved with the, you know, philosophy is preparation for death. Is it on a Christian interpretation, literally preparation for the afterlife, or is it on an existentialist interpretation?
Exactly.
Preparation for death. Living authentically is being exactly unto death. And so let's not decide the matter here. I can very much see that Nietzsche, being a classical scholar and very steeped in Plato, like the fact that he wrote his eternal recurrence myth the way that he did, it's exactly the same take on myth that at least one could reasonably derive from this. So it's kind of even the wrong question maybe to ask. Did Nietzsche literally believe that is that a metaphysical principle of his or not? I think he was purposely vague about it in a way that it's not merely using it as a myth, because then the answer would definitely be, no, of course Nietzsche didn't actually believe that. It's just a point to illustrate that you should live authentically.
Well, there's three levels, because there's a metaphysical principle, and then there's the myth taken literally as true, and then there's the illustration of some sort of moral directive. So Nietzsche could have thought that eternal recurrence was a metaphysical principle without believing it was literally true.
That's a little too subtle for me. Is there a corresponding point in Plato?
Well, you can believe that recollection is a metaphysical principle without believing it, that it's literally
true.
There
you go.
Kant is describing a form of recollection, the sense in which cognitive capacities a priori inject all this stuff into our experience of the world. The recollection gets at the a priori element of things. That's a metaphysical principle, although Kant would call it a critical principle. But if you describe it as recollection, I don't think it's to be taken literally. But anyway, I think, yeah, we got the ambiguity here. And
hey, before we go on, let's talk about our sponsors, the first of which is a new one, Blue Apron. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Now, I've used this service for a while. Wes has used this service. I am by no means a good chef, but I can follow recipes. And the meals that Blue Apron has provided me with have really been uniformly very fancy compared to what I would do on my own. High-quality gourmet kind of recipes, but also completely doable for me. And if you do a bunch of them, then little by little you get some of the basic skills that people who actually know how to cook have. Of, you know, how to peel and chop certain things. And so generally the only time that I would make an actual recipe is if I go to the grocery store with the recipe in my hand and buy all the stuff, which means I only do that like once every 2 years. Blue Apron delivers these to your house multiple times a week. And a really great thing about it is the quality of the ingredients. They're fresh, high quality ingredients that taste better and are better for you than if you just bought, you know, the frozen version of this dish. Blue Apron sets high quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. Just to give you some examples, some of the meals available in July are creamy shrimp fettuccine with sauteed green beans and spinach, sweet chili chicken with Tinkerbell peppers, green beans, and jasmine rice, and spiced steak and tomato avocado salad with creamy cone cabbage and red onion slaw. You get to specify, you know, do you want vegetarian options? Do you want to exclude red meat? Stuff like that. And even within the selection, you have choices. You can go online every week and pick what you want or just take the default stuff. If you're doing something else for that particular week, you can have fewer meals sent to you. You could suspend it altogether. Really, you should just check it out because it's a pretty awesome service. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/PEL. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/PEL. All right, now Wes and Dylan, tell us about St. John's.
This episode of Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree-granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in Annapolis, Maryland. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's College Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books are the teachers, and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well.
And Dylan, you're actually a tutor.
Yes, and you were actually a student.
I was actually a student. So we can say from experience, yeah, if there's one thing I learned at St. John's, it was how to have these sorts of conversations because it's an all-seminar style format. There are no textbooks and there are no lectures, really. You go to class and you've read a text and then you talk about that with other students and the tutor, and the tutors are sort of laid back and let the students run the show. So whether it's philosophy or literature or math or science, which you're required to do all of those things, that's the way you learn. So you're very engaged. It's a very active form of learning, and you're not just sitting in a lecture hall scribbling on a pad as someone else talks.
Yeah, one of the things I liked best about being a tutor, and it seemed like the students liked about having tutors in the format of St. John's, is that the faculty really are fellow learners.
Yeah, so if you like PEL, St. John's might be the place for you. If you've wanted to do this type of thing, have these types of conversations, St. John's is the, you know, they call it the Great Book School, sort of the place to do this.
The Graduate Institute is currently accepting applications for 2016 and subsequent terms. Applications are accepted and decisions are made on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week Film Studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. If you are a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJ SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
We know you're out Americaing this weekend over the 4th of July, but Brian Wilson here wanting to remind you of some of our upcoming PEL Not School seminars. I'll be holding a seminar on Monday, July 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Montaigne's Of the Education of Children of Cannibals. Both these works have tremendous application today in terms of the idea of individual and group education and societal or cultural norms. Next up, we have a proposal by John Arndt on the American historian and Hudson Institute senior fellow Arthur Herman's The Cave and the Light. This work explores the tension between the ideas of Aristotle and Plato and their impact on modern civilization. Lastly, PEL has teamed up with The Great Discourses, an online seminar series led by Adam Rose, University of Chicago instructor and great books lover par excellence. PEL citizens get 20% off by following the link in the Citizens Forum. Some upcoming seminars from The Great Discourses include Abbott's Flatland and Wells' The Time Machine, The Book of Job and The Invention of Faith, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and Homer's Odyssey. To participate, you simply have to become a PEL citizen, meaning pay $5 a month, $5 being a crazily low rate to pay for this kind of personal interaction and instruction. And of course, it also includes the full-length ad-free version of the entire PEL podcast back catalog. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me at brian@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Hope to see you at a seminar soon.
Hey, and just so you know, even if you don't become a Partially Examined Life citizen, you can still take advantage of that Great Discourses partnership and get 15% off any of their courses by using the discount code PELIFE at checkout. All right, let's get back to it.
Before we pass on from the speech, just want to point out that I think that all of the same issues apply to the philosophical treatise component, which is that the argument here is that the philosophical treatise is also a piece of rhetoric and therefore also, at best, a likeness to the truth and not the truth itself. That the philosophical treatise and the myth are two different ways of doing the same thing, and one may be more or less successful, but
right.
We shouldn't mistake the treatise part for truth in this particular dialogue.
I think that's a really good point, and it gets at the sense in which language never fully escapes metaphor. This is why there's such a big problem with when to say literally and when not to say it. And there are actually border cases where it's unclear because language is so inherently and heavily metaphorical. So even if I'm writing like Aristotle, there are metaphorical elements to that. They're just not as obvious. So if I enhance that, if I put the metaphor on steroids and make it obvious, yeah, I think arguably you've done a service to the reader in that sense. They can't fall into the confusion that there's nothing non-literal in the text they're engaged with.
So are there any other elements? I don't want us to dwell on too much about what the chariot is doing as it goes around following the gods. I guess the one literal point about this that I wanted to get that was kind of raised earlier was what explains who we find beautiful? And it's not subjective. It's not just anybody, whatever you think. Still, different people have different types. And he gives one possible explanation here in the myth, which is that who is your chariot following around the heavens? Are you following around Zeus? Are you following around Ares? Are you following around Hera? And each of these will kind of give you different character type, at least, that you are ultimately attracted to. And that once you locate the beloved and love them in that way, I love you for your wisdom because I was a follower of Zeus, you know, before I was born.
Since we've already mentioned Freud, when I was reading that, I wrote down in my notes transference. So this is sort of like the Platonic version of transference, which for Freud is this idea that all your love relations, all your love objects, who you find to be a love object, depends upon something that happened in the past. Recollection is once again the paradigm. Transference is just a different way of saying that. So in the case of Freud, it could be your parents, for instance, you know, who you find attractive could be modeled in some sense on one parent or the other or other people in your lives. Here, it's on the gods. That becomes really important as this section goes on.
Well, I guess so. The way that it becomes important if we're ultimately getting at why does love benefit the beloved? It's because if you transfer the qualities of Apollo, say, onto your beloved, then what you're really doing is you end up encouraging the beloved to be more like Apollo, to have those particular virtues, to be virtuous. I mean, they're all gods. They're all virtuous.
Yeah, the dynamic is really interesting here because at first it's because they are like, there's some seed of them, you know, there's something rudimentary that is like Apollo. That's why you love them. But then you want to make them even more like Apollo. So you do that work and that's how you improve them.
Right, at 253C, and this is in the case of Hera, but at the end of that sentence, it says his every act is aimed at bringing the beloved to be every whit like unto himself and unto the God of their worship. So what you've got here essentially is kind of a master-apprentice relationship, and that the lover as the master and the beloved as an apprentice, that the good that the master does the apprentice is helping the apprentice become a master, and both of them become more like the God of which they're a type or associated with. And this is the contrast to Lysias's speech and Socrates' first speech, is that now what's being purportedly demonstrated here is that the interests of the lover and the beloved are not antagonistic. They're not mutually exclusive, that they actually right. have conjoined interests. And that's what makes the union beneficial to both of them, but in particular makes it beneficial to the beloved.
So what if you want to make your beloved more like Hades? Because Hades is one of them.
Well, there is talk of Ares, right? So let me just read this because it sounded like murder-suicide. So yeah, so that's 252C. So yes. Now he who is a follower of Zeus, when seized by love, can bear a heavier burden of the winged god. But those who are servants of Ares and followed in his train, when they have been seized by love and think that they have been wronged in any way by the beloved, become murderous and are ready to sacrifice themselves and the beloved. So that's an unsavory model, let's say.
So some gods are better than others to follow, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, it's clear that Zeus is the highest of the gods. I mean, this is at 252E. But the followers of Zeus seek a beloved who is Zeus-like in soul. Mm-hmm. Wherefore, they look for one who is by nature disposed to the love of wisdom and the leading of men. And I take it that's the highest that there is.
And then where was the part, Wes, that you were trying to quote before of when he brings the imagery of the horses back? Pretty much, I want to get at, why does love constitute a harmonious relation between these three parts of the soul?
I think it's like 253E that starts.
So then, when the charioteer, seeing the beloved's eye, or literally the erotic eye, heating his whole soul through with the sensation, begins to be filled with the goads of tickling and yearning, that one of the horses who is obedient to the charioteer, then as always forcibly constrained by a sense of shame, holds himself back from rushing upon the beloved. The other one no longer turns in heed either to the charioteer's goads or whip, but leaps and is carried along by force, and presenting all possible troubles to its yoke-mate and charioteer, compels them to go toward the boyfriend, and to make mention of the delight of sexual gratification. What do your translations say for the make mention of the delights of sexual gratifications?
Delights of love's commerce.
There you go. I know the Jowett did not actually have the word sexual in it.
Propose the joys of love.
These two in the beginning strive against it with irritation on the grounds that they are being compelled to terrible and unlawful things. But at last, when there is no end to the evil, they are led to go on, giving way and agreeing to do what is bidden. And they come before him and see the boyfriend's face, flashing like lightning. And as the charioteer sees, his memory is carried toward the nature of beauty and sees it once more together with moderation, standing on a chaste pedestal. And upon seeing he is afraid and feeling awe, recoils on his back, and at the same time is compelled to pull the reins back so vehemently that both horses sit down on their haunches, the one willingly, though not striving against it, the wanton one very unwillingly. As the two withdraw farther off, the one soaks the whole soul with sweat from shame and amazement. The other, ceasing from the pain that it had from the bit and the fall, barely catching its breath, reviles them in anger, bad-mouthing the charioteer and its yoke-mate in many ways on the grounds that through cowardice and unmanliness they quit the rank in agreement.
Yeah, I love that.
And in compelling them against their wish to go forward again, it barely yields to their begging to put it off until later. And when the agreed-upon time comes, of which the two pretend to be unmindful, by reminding, constraining, neighing, pulling, it compels them again to approach the boyfriend for the purpose of the same speeches. And when they are nearby, it stoops down, stretches out its tail, and champs at the bit, and so pulls with shamelessness. The charioteer, however, suffering the same experience, still more recoiling as if from the starting gate, drawing the bit still more with force back out of the wanton horse's teeth, bloodies the evil-speaking tongue and jaws, and causing its upper legs and haunches to rest upon the earth, gives them over to pains. And when, by suffering the same thing many times, the knavish one ceases from wantonness, having been humbled at last, it follows the charioteer's forethought. And whenever it sees the beautiful one, it is utterly destroyed by fear, so that at last happens that the lover's soul follows the boyfriend, feeling a sense of shame and dread.
Yeah, so what I think's important here is we have a force of attraction, but we need a force of repulsion, essentially. And that force will be reverence. And the reason why that's important is because you need more than the lover simply consuming the beloved for its gratification in the way the first speech is described. So that's what introducing this otherworldly reverence does. It balances out the desire side of things, because if it is all just lust or something like that, then the lover certainly is not good for the beloved. They simply want to consume them. But you get away from mere consumption with the reverence part, pull it, then that eventually brings that bad horse to heel.
That was a very nice demonstration of philosophical drama, because the tone of voice in which you read that whole thing really put a very particular spin on the passage. And I think if you read the same passage with a different tone of voice, it would lead you to something else. And I think Plato and Socrates are being serious about this, whether you or I want to follow them down there, but that there's something about this, and that this final paragraph at 254e is about the lover ultimately being able to discipline his soul. And now we're back to what's the purpose of life on earth and what's the purpose of love? That apparently these are opportunities for us to cultivate better souls than we started with. And it's not so much that the reverence or the awe is a repulsive force, I don't think.
It is a repulsive force in the sense that he pulls back. The charioteer pulls back.
Yes, but that's the soul itself attempting to discipline itself.
Right. So that's the repulsive force. If he weren't disciplining himself, he would simply move towards the love object.
Yeah, but it's not like the love object itself has a repulsive force outward.
Right. No, I wasn't trying to say that it was repelling. Right.
You're right. But so the point here, I think, is that love provides the opportunity for souls to become better souls. And both the lover's soul becomes better because he's forced to tame himself, and the beloved soul becomes better because he's apprenticed to a master. I think the dramatic element of this is at the very end of the dialogue at 279b, when they're just about to quit and go away, Phaedrus says, "Now let us be going. It has become less oppressively hot." This whole thing's been happening during the midday. And I take it that Socrates is smitten with Phaedrus in this way, but is able to discipline his own soul in a way until the heat passes, as it were, and then they can go.
We haven't really said how the beloved can be improved from this. This whole idea of discipline in the lover, we get that sense of improvement, but there's a lot more detail on how it is that this whole scenario can improve the beloved.
Before we get away from this image, I mean, both of you were saying what the benefit of having the repulsive force or having the superego or whatever is. But the wrinkle here is that if you didn't have the desire in the first place, if you didn't have the bad horse, you would never initiate the love relation in the first place. There has to be sort of a pre-disciplined id or whatever that is out of control to get things started. Otherwise, shame would just make it so that we wouldn't have this opportunity to better our souls. So that is ultimately the wrinkle in the balance between the tripartite soul. It's not just that the rational part of the soul, which I guess is the charioteer, and the spirited part of the soul, the honorable warrior part of the soul, which is the good horse. It's not just that reason needs to be in charge and use the spirited part of the soul to control desire, the third part of the soul. If we are saying this maps exactly onto the way he did in the Republic, which is not entirely clear to me. But in any case, it's not just that the bad horse is desire that must be controlled. It's that there is a function for desire, a positive right. function. Which we didn't see in the Republic as clearly anyway.
We need to have both the moving toward and the moving away. It's all moving away, there's no relationship. But if it's all moving toward, you destroy the object. So we need an in-between here. We need the chance for an actual relationship with another person, which is what this push and pull allows.
Or that in a certain sense, life in this world, or the love object as we're calling it, it makes life here kind of like a soul gymnasium, where we have to go and work out in order to improve our soul fitness, and that will actually allow our soul to come to a better end after it leaves this realm. This idea of there being a gymnasium for the soul, mm-hmm. and that you can have a flabby soul or a six-pack soul, and it's a metaphor, but it's a likeness to truth, mm-hmm. and that philosophy is what helps us get our soul in the peak of fitness for our own well-being.
We got how it can be improving for the lover. But how it's improving for the beloved is a different story, actually.
Yes.
Well, I think we've gotten it out. At least what I had said before is that we're trying to make the beloved into more of the image of the God that we first saw in them. So we're trying to improve them. Was there more to the story than that?
It's along the same lines, but the next step in this account, he revisits that. So eventually the lover is admitted to the society of the beloved, right? The beloved gives in and lets them hang out. And there's an intimacy there that kind of makes familial and friendly relations pale in comparison. And then there's this close proximity. And then he uses this metaphor of the sort of fountain of desire overflowing from the lover onto the beloved. Another metaphor here is that the stream of beauty, sort of the beauty that's emanating from the beloved, bounces back onto the beautiful one. It's like they're seeing themselves in a mirror. And so their feathers sort of get stirred as well. So they get filled with love. So in other words, the loving of the beloved creates love in them. And they get the same benefits from being filled with that yearning. That's part of the story. It goes on from there.
Being properly loved turns a beloved into a lover.
Was it part of the mirror thing is that people can't see their own beauty? It's when somebody else sees the beauty in you and then you see yourself through their eyes, then you see that you're beautiful.
Well, no, and you're not. Benefit of that. I don't think you're thinking you're beautiful. You're thinking the other person is beautiful, even though the other person is sort of reflecting you.
I don't know. This is just something I got from one of the iTunes lectures that I watched about this that was raising a sort of Hegelian point, making a big deal out of this mirror aspect.
I thought it was a Bruno Mars point.
This is what Freud would call a narcissistic transference. So the love of the other is also the love of the self. But I think what the beloved is now feeling love is now a lover towards the lover. I mean, I think that's an important aspect of this. So.
With the same need to discipline himself.
Right.
That same iTunes lecture that I was watching, it actually brought in this, yes, that does sound narcissistic, and the transference part. So it's like the lover becomes a fantasist. I don't actually love you. I love the God I see in you, the God I am projecting upon you and trying to make you into. I don't love you the way you are. I'm just trying to change you. There's something empty about that. And then likewise, if you go with that interpretation that what the beloved is getting out of it is this narcissistic sense of their own beauty, that's part of it, that I am lovable, then isn't there something kind of messed up about?
See, I disagree with that interpretation, at least as the primary interpretation. The beloved is getting out of it as they become a lover as well, not just of themselves, but the other person.
Well, and at 256b, or just above the B, this is where I think it becomes somewhat symmetrical. In my translation, it says, "And so, if the victory be won by the higher elements of mind, guiding them, both of them, into the ordered rule of the philosophical life, their days on earth will be blessed with happiness and concord, for the power of evil in the soul has been subjected, and the power of goodness liberated. They have won self-mastery and inward peace, and when life is over, with burden shed and wings recovered, they stand victorious in the first of the three rounds in that truly Olympic struggle. Nor can any nobler prize be secured, whether by the wisdom that is of man or by the madness that is of God."
So that's the part that I was saying, that ultimately no sex.
Well, let me read to you just from above that at 256a.
That's the best kind.
Yes, yes.
"So now they lie together. The unruly horse of the lover has something to say to the charioteer and demands a little enjoyment in return for his many troubles. And the unruly horse of the beloved says nothing, but teeming with passion and confused emotions, he embraces and kisses his lover, caressing him as his best friend." So there's some physical intimacy here, even though it's friendly. "And when they lie together, he would not refuse his lover any favor if he asked it. But the other horse and charioteer oppose all this with modesty and reason." And I didn't see this opposition as overcoming. Like, it sounds to me like the beloved actually gives in to some extent to the advances, despite the sort of charioteer and the other horse saying, we shouldn't be doing this, but okay.
But apropos of the beloved becoming a lover, and I think you would end up having the lover becoming a beloved, as this goes along, there's a kind of symbiotic symmetry in there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, and that they fly up together to a higher existence.
So that's going to happen whether or not they successfully resist the sexual urge and enter into a well-arranged life and philosophy. That's going to be the best possible way, but love is beneficial even if you don't achieve that awesome platonic love, even if you give in and there's sex involved, as long as the sex is not the driving force behind the relationship and the only thing good about it.
Yeah, I guess there's just so much patently erotic and sexually charged language. I just don't see how it's exclusive of it being erotic life properly understood.
Yeah, in other words, it sounds like there actually can be something platonic to a love relationship, even if there actually is also sexual intimacy. One doesn't preclude the other. It can be challenging, I think, to maintain the platonic part.
It wouldn't be with Alcibiades, right?
All right, well, we read the quotes. We can see how one could have either interpretation and how Christians could run with this and say, oh, yes, that's exactly right. No sex for Jesus, no sex for the saints, because that's the best way. You can still be virtuous and give in. Most of us, that's what'll happen. But, you know, here's the ideal.
I guess this is the part that I'm reacting against. Maybe there's this whole history of non-erotic, erotic devotion. But it's just, when I read the Platonic dialogues, it's just so clear that there's just a straight line from our erotic passions to philosophy, properly understood in Plato. It's just a straight line.
Yes. Hallelujah. Yes. But I think it's back to the thing about the shadows and the cave. And this is the whole thing about the symposium, that the visible is where we start. And it's where most people end. But for the philosopher, the visible is where we start, and it's where we get an inkling of something more than the visible. And then once we get that inkling of something more than the visible, we turn to that thing and don't be so preoccupied with the visible.
Right.
You know, the visible is the on-ramp
right.
to reality.
And by contrast, so if you look at 256e, he describes what you get from the non-lover. So, these blessings so great and so divine, the friendship of the lover will confer upon you. So he starts talking about the friendship of the lover. That's the platonic part alongside with the erotic part. Or actually, that's not a good way of putting it. You know, the friend plus lover aspect of things, which we've been describing. So the friendship of the lover will confer upon you, dear boy, but the affection of the non-lover, which is alloyed with mortal prudence and follows mortal and parsimonious rules of conduct, will beget in the beloved soul the narrowness which the common folk praise as virtue. It will cause the soul to be a wonder upon the earth for 9,000 years and a fool below the earth at last. So this common idea of virtue as simply not giving in to desire, repressing at all costs, that's not what's going on here. That's why I like this idea of both the push and the pull being necessary. It's not simply this exclusion of lust or physical desire. I don't think that's what's going on here.
Well, it wouldn't be repressing. It would be sublimating.
Right. Sure.
If you say that platonic love ultimately doesn't have sex in it and that's the best kind, it's not because there's no erotic attraction. No, definitely there's erotic attraction and that is energizing. But as the guy in Dr. Strangelove says, I don't want to drain my vital essences on the...
No, but the reason why I read that passage is just because the non-lover thing is what I think people typically think of as platonic love, right? That's the image they have. And that's the thing he's rejecting.
Although the funny thing, and I don't know that this is made clear, but one of the lecturers that I was reading, when this whole thing at the beginning with Lysias talking about the lover and the non-lover, again, that sounds like the one who wants to have sex with you and the one who doesn't. That's not what it means. It's the one who actually loves you and wants to have sex with you because of that, and the one who doesn't love you, but still wants to have sex with you as a friend. So that's what's being compared here. Whose favors are you going to accept? In other words, who are you going to have hook up with? Somebody who actually is crazy about you or somebody that's just friends with benefits. That's
I wish you'd clarified that when I said, let's define what favors mean at the very beginning.
I thought that was, well, I think this is a pretty good place to get close to wrapping up. I think, you know, there's a lot more of the dialogue left about rhetoric, but we've been pretty good about touching on the points relevant to rhetoric as we've been going through the speeches about love. But I'm sure some of you have particular notes, things standing out, underlined, that you want to spell them out. So here's your opportunity.
We got through the second speech, and there's the whole third of the dialogue left that we could easily spend a whole bunch more time on.
I just didn't find that part that interesting. I mean, we've got, do these rhetoricians treat rhetoric as a science or not? If they don't have a definition of rhetoric, if they don't have a definition of the soul, if they don't have an understanding of the soul, and they're not using a knowledge of truth to drive the rhetoric, then it's not an art at all. It's just a bunch of correlations they've come with. Oh, if I put forth a swooning metaphor here, then people will swoon at that. You know, they have a lot of sort of empirical rules, but it doesn't amount to being an art. And this is what we just already discussed in the Gorgias episode, ad nauseum. What is in here over and above what was in the Gorgias?
But what if no one's listened to the Gorgias?
Then they can go listen to that right after this one. The one last point, which we already said at the beginning about writing versus speech, I think...
Well, there's so much good stuff in this writing versus speech section. I mean,
in just summarizing it, I already gave it. You're saying there's so much stuff in that? It seems like it's very short.
I don't think it'll take much time, but we do just want to touch on this whole art of writing thing, since it's part of what the Phaedrus is famous for.
Sure.
Personally, I think the second part is where most of the meat of the dialogue is. At the top level, and I think this goes into why the two halves of the dialogue exist together, it's not a random choice. The part about love is about the human soul and about, you know, we've just talked about this, disciplining your soul and getting into the philosophical life. And this account of scientific rhetoric is a kind of, I mean, literally soul therapy, psychotherapy. It's really how you can bring people into the philosophical life, I think. The episode with Phaedrus himself is an instantiation of that, that Phaedrus in this dialogue is brought to the philosophical life through the employment of scientific rhetoric. And therefore, the second half is, well, okay, what is scientific rhetoric and how is it done and what are its limitations and so on?
Very good sum up. Any particular points, Dylan or Wes or Adam, that you feel like we need to...
Just to say what I think about the writing section. I mean, so he starts off with a myth about how sort of the invention of writing was supposed to improve memory. And in fact, it turns out to be the opposite. It leads to forgetfulness because it discourages people from actually using their own memories when you can actually
like
write something down. Yeah, exactly.
You can't do arithmetic anymore.
Or Google.
Right. Yep.
So this is one god talking to another. You have invented an elixir, not of memory, but of reminding. And you offer your pupils the appearance of wisdom, not true wisdom, for they will read many things without instruction and seem to know many things. So it's one thing to write for someone who already knows something and can be reminded of it. But writing per se isn't a way to actually impart knowledge. It can remind those you know, but it can't give knowledge to people. That can only come through engaged discourse where words can actually be questioned and where the word has a sort of living presence. So here's another quote. 276D.
Okay. He will sow his seed in literary gardens.
Yeah, go ahead and read what you think is the
okay,
good part.
Okay, well, I could just preface this by saying that I think at the highest level here, one of the things that's being done is that there's kind of a spectrum of the ways in which speech can be used scientifically. And if we had a whiteboard, I'd kind of put it up on the board. But on the one hand, there's what you could call oral dialectic. Now, dialectic only comes in oral form, but let's just do it for clarity. And that this is true living speech, and it's the give and take between two souls in pursuit of the truth. It turns out that there's also something that you could call oral rhetoric, properly understood. That's what Socrates did in his couple of speeches in the first part, that these are kind of set speeches, so they're not dialectic, but on the other hand, they're not written down. So it's oral rhetoric. And then on the other hand, you have written rhetoric, like what Lysias had done or other people have done, which Socrates calls dead speech. So you have a kind of a continuum here between oral dialectic on the one hand, which is living speech, and written rhetoric, which is dead speech. And then it's kind of like oral rhetoric, which is in between the two. It's not quite fully alive. It's not quite fully dead, but at least it could provide kind of like a gateway to oral dialectic. And so when you look at the passage that Wes was talking about at 276D, talking about somebody who's writing, or actually we start just a little bit above that, Socrates says at the end of C, it won't be with serious intent that he writes them in water or that black fluid we call ink, using his pen to sow words that can't either speak in their own defense or present the truth adequately. Phaedrus says, it certainly isn't likely. Socrates says, no, it is not. He will sow his seed in literary gardens, I take it, and write when he does write by way of a pastime, collecting a store of refreshment, both for his own memory, against the day when age oblivious comes, and for all such as tread in his footsteps. And he will take pleasure in watching the tender plants grow up, and when other men resort to other pastimes, regaling themselves with drinking parties and such like, he will doubtless prefer to indulge in the recreation I refer to. Phaedrus says, and what an excellent one it is, Socrates. How far superior to the other sort is the recreation that a man finds in words when he discourses about justice and other topics you speak of. And Socrates says, "Yes, indeed, dear Phaedrus. But far more excellent, I think, is the serious treatment of them, which employs the art of dialectic. The dialectician selects a soul of the right type, and in it he plants and sows his words founded on knowledge, words which can defend both themselves and him who planted them, words which instead of remaining barren contain a seed whence new words grow up in new characters, whereby the seed is vouchsafed immortality and its possessor the fullest measure of blessedness that man can attain unto." And I take it that these last two paragraphs of Socrates are part of the punchline, that writing, even serious philosophical style writing, is ultimately philosophical masturbation, that it can only be done for the pleasure of the person who's doing it, and it has no effect otherwise. But that dialectic is true philosophical intercourse, and it's philosophical intercourse in which the lover begets upon the beloved by impregnating the beloved with the seed of knowledge. And that seed of knowledge takes root in the beloved, and then the beloved is impregnated, is pregnant, and becomes knowledgeable or wise. And that is the greatest boon that a lover can impart on a beloved. Now you can see the whole sexual metaphor here. I mean, I think it's really casting, begetting knowledge, the lover begetting knowledge through philosophical intercourse with the beloved.
It's my favorite type of intercourse.
Well, according to this dialogue, it's the only one worth having.
Sometimes it's the only kind you get.
You think you could set up like a Tinder service or something for philosophical intercourse?
I try to weave philosophical intercourse into my actual erotic, erotic relations.
How's that working out for you? People will listen to a lot of shit come out of your mouth when the ire is hot, but when the desire dies down, then they're like, "Ah, I don't want to talk about this with you anymore." Can we respond in defense of writing briefly? I think he's pointing out an important pedagogical issue. You can't just learn from writing, but keeping that in mind, I think that philosophers are correctly responding to this when instead of, say, like the guy who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, "I only need to write one book. Oh, no, I'll write a second book, you know, 15 years later, and then I'm done. I don't need to explain myself any further. Fuck you. Just figure it out." That is the wrong way. Whereas your typical professional philosopher who rewrites the same goddamn thing in slightly different ways 50 times and explores different avenues and is kind of responding to everybody else in the field, that actually overcomes to some extent the problem with dead speech, because you get a lot of dead speech and it adds up to alive.
So at St. John's, of course, we value this idea of conversation. Instead of lectures, which often are just much like reading from
their set speeches,
something that's already written, but yeah, set speeches, but you know, that we actually have these conversations and that you are active when you are, you read something, you're not just a passive recipient of the words, you are active with regard to them. And you can take that with you outside of the classroom, outside of actual discussions. So you can, you know, the number of times I've simply read a passage, a difficult philosophical passage, and then walked around and really thought about it and done something new with it, right? Developed my own thoughts according to it, try to rethink it, as in go through the process of thinking that might have led to the particular thing that was written. Or as I do with these podcasts, I write summaries of everything I read. It illustrates to me how little I actually understand of what I've read. You can have the illusion that you've actually, "Oh yeah, I get it. I understand it." If you just read it, well, try summarizing it, try rewriting it in your own words, and you'll have a whole different perspective on it. So there are ways to be engaged with the text that are active, that don't involve conversation. That's the one thing I would say.
And that don't involve a superior imparting wisdom to you in a dialectical way. Like this particular model of the older, wiser lover influencing the beloved, that is far from the only way to effectively.
And you can criticize dialectic as involving a certain amount of passivity on the recipient. I mean, I think Phaedrus is a little more active than other interlocutors in the Platonic dialogues, but for the most part, he's passive to the point where when I was doing my summary, now I don't pause to talk about what Phaedrus said. Everything is in the voice of Socrates and might as well be.
Yeah. And that is one thing that seems to be common in the dialogues is the characters who seem to be most favored also seem to be very passive. And the ones who are not particularly favored seem to be the ones that are the most active. I'm thinking of like Thrasymachus in the first book of the Republic. He's clearly not favored, unlike Glaucon and Adeimantus. But he's the one who actually presents arguments engaging with Socrates, whereas Glaucon and Adeimantus, you know, they ask one or two questions. Is it really the case that the just man who no one recognizes as being just really leads a better life? How is that possible? But those are like sort of transitory questions that allow for Socrates to continue on with what he's doing, as opposed to what someone like Thrasymachus is doing, which is actually engaging him and arguing with him. And I think you see a similar thing with Phaedrus here. Phaedrus is a vehicle for us to hear what Socrates is saying.
Yeah, and it's never been clear to me that what goes on in these dialogues is actually dialectic.
The closest one would be something like Meno, the conversation with the slave boy in Meno.
Yeah, but I'm not even sure that Plato is actually trying to show us dialectic with the dialogues, with their form.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. It seems on the surface of it that one of the reasons he would pick doing dialogues rather than simply writing speeches or something like a treatise would be to come up with some way to embody the dialectic or at least the conversational aspect of a Socratic encounter. And that it seems like at least that's the obvious reason he would do it. And it has to be at least that, right?
What I'm suggesting, is that he may well be doing that, but that it's not the quality of the back and forth between the dramatis personae that actually conveys the dialectic. I think there may be something else.
Well, I mean, if you're saying that in the dialogue itself that, you know, Socrates kind of talks the dialectic talk, but is not depicted as really walking the dialectic walk fully, that may be the case. But I think if you take this passage seriously, at least that, you know, as you were saying earlier, that it's affirming the necessity of agency on the part of a learner, on the part of a beloved. So this whole idea, whether you do Socratic method, like at St. John's or some other place, but this idea that even if it's not depicted in its full glory in the dialogue, and this is what's wrong with set speeches, whether they're oral or ultimately written, is that the beloved has to start grinding his mental hips too. I mean, if he doesn't start getting into the action, that knowledge is not actually going to grow within the beloved. And I think, you know, the last thing that, you know, maybe this is an interesting place to kind of wrap up or something, but that this indictment of writing by a guy who's a writer, of course, then raises this whole paradox of what did Plato think he's up to? And, you know, there's a school of thought out there taking this in conjunction with Plato's seventh letter that Plato seriously never meant to convey any positive doctrine of any kind. And that in Plato's understanding, these writings could serve functions, maybe not just literary pastimes, but that they were not intended ever as statements of truth about anything.
I agree. And I think the Phaedrus illustrates that very well. So I don't think the dialogues are meant to illustrate agency on the part of interlocutors or learners. They just don't. So I think what the interlocutors add, what I think they do illustrate is certain kinds of approaches to reasoning things through. But you could easily write a dialogue with a much more advanced interlocutor where it would be a real match. It would be a real debate. And of course, Plato understood that he could have written something like that, and he didn't. So he's trying to do something else.
He's trying to just inspire us to remember before we were born when we had a lot of dialectic conversations, that this at least reminds you.
There is also the school of thought that whether or not these dialogues are intended as kind of infomercials for Plato's Academy, that actually all these dialogues were more or less meant for novices or for people who weren't doing it. You want to do more of this? Register now at the Academy, and we're going to do this live and in person and get rid of this book shit.
So the scrolls are 400 BC's version of YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one way that people look at these. I'm not here to affirm or contradict that, but that is one theory of what's going on here, that the dialogues, maybe not all of them, but in general, are kind of invitations to philosophy in various ways.
Well, clearly, the upshot of all this talk about the dialectic and how spoken is better than written, it was all just reached its culmination in Hegel's logic and the encyclopedia logic. And laying out once and for all in a long text. Exactly.
I thought you were going to say that that this conversational back and forth dialectic has reached its culmination in PEL.
I thought you were going to say that it reached its orgasm.
We've had people write to us that say every time that they hear the closing music, they have an orgasm. Several people have written in saying that.
Well, that's what we call, you know, the aha moments.
Eureka.
All right. Thank you so much, Adam, for joining us.
Thanks, Adam. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Folks should remember to, so you're teaching one of the courses,
right?
Yeah, I'll
be teaching a course on Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which has the main character named Phaedrus, and also we'll be reading and talking about Phaedrus by Plato as preparation for reading the novel, and also teaching a few other classes over the summer. We've got a class by a colleague, Principles of Roman Stoicism. We've got one on the Canterbury Tales, Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. So you can check us out at greatdiscourses.com and see what we've got coming up.
I think there's a whole course on whether it's pronounced Phaedrus or Phaedrus or Phaedrus or Phaedrus. Is that what you just...
It depends what language you're in.
All right, folks should go join the conversation. Don't be so damn passive. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and join us in a not school group, or just respond to the blog post about this episode. We've got the Facebook group. If you're hooked up that way, we've got Twitter. You can follow us that way. We've got so many ways of connecting with us. Please donate money to help this continue to happen. Thanks so much to everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
You're out and running in the park, feeling sun upon your skin. The flowers are in bloom. If I make it through the tune, this is what I'm gonna do. What I'm gonna do. Wander out into the trees with a bottle of fine wine. You're not behind, you're right there where you're supposed to be. Beneath your favorite tree. Pretty as the sun goes down, you're smiling, you're just hanging round.